Accession number 23433, reel 9.
Jeff Kirk, reel 9.
I went to do the research, and it was a Friday, and luckily there's not many people there on a Friday. So I got to, but I got stuck because I went through everyone on there, you know, and I couldn't find this Keith Davenport. So I said to one of them staff there, I can't find it. He said, oh, what number? That's what I gave the reel. I said, is the number this reel? He said, let's go and look up the book. So I went out the book, where'd you find it? Oh, yeah, there. So then he got the other book out and went through that, and then he went back and he got another reel, and then he starts whizzing through it. So I said, it's not in alphabetical order, you know. Oh, he said, oh, no, it's in date order. And he picked up the date from somewhere, because the funny thing, before that he produced a book with all the awards in them, and Air Regiment's not even mentioned. In fact, I don't think any Royal Armour Corps regiment, the Royal Tank Regiment mentioned, but not the Royal Armour Corps. So he said, he went to England, he says, no KH Davenport down anything. So then he went away and got another reel, and he whizzed through it. And he said, there it is, and he produced it for me. And what it was a periodic award. It was the things he did in the war. They quote three particular instances. Like, the first one was when he got out with a tank commander and rescued some of the wounded infantrymen and put them in comparative safety, they said, right? The next one was he got out and fixed tow ropes to tow the tanks out of Bucktown. And the third one was Sherman Dozer caught fire, and he got up there and helped them put it out. You know, it said regardless of exploding ammunition, he got up and helped them, you know, fight the fire night. And then it was initiated in July 45, signed by the Brigadier and everybody else, like, right up to... Percy Hobart. Percy Hobart was Lance Corporal Hobart. I don't know if you know. Like, did you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, he's a general to Percy Hobart. He was the officer commanding the 79th Armoured Div. And the 79th, they used to call them Hobart Funnies. That was a Churchill Crocodile, the Wasps, the Flail Tank, the Royal Engineers Avery, they were called Royal Engineers, you know, where they had all the weight charge and everything else on, and the petard thing. And they called him Lance Corporal Hobart because he existed all these things in 1939 and 40, and they said, discharge, you're too old for the army. Well, Churchill, as soon as he took over, called him back in and told him to get on and develop these things. Well, he developed the swimming tank, you know, the Donald Duck, we used to call it, didn't we? You know, the one where it sinks down with a screen up around, and the flail tanks, the Averys, the crocodiles, that. And let's see, we used to call him Lance Corporal Hobart because in the period before he got called back in the army, he joined the Home Guard and became a Lance Corporal. As he had everybody call him Lance Corporal Hobart, like. And he invented them. Anyway, I went through this and I found his periodic award, so he's now going to mention to Keith Henry Davenport MM. But you see, the records of it, everything is there. The problem is finding it, you know, knowing the drill. I even found the logbook of one of my wife's great grandfather's boats. You know, I found out where it was born, it was made of Wivenhoe, and then it went to a thing. And I didn't realise then that all boats are sold in 64ths. Even these million down blokes have got 64 shares divided up into 64. And I said to my daughter, because she's in the shipping line, I said, why is that? She said, you can divide a 64th up, you can half it, quarter it, do what you like with it.
Interesting.
And, it's still, I said, today? She said, yeah. It's still done in 64 shares. But it's all there, and that logbook was all folded up with a big staple for it. Like, you know, you get it in a box out, and there it is, get all the measurements and things. I try to find, but the job of finding crews, of captains of boats, because half of them weren't registered.
Right.
That's it, so there's nothing for it. It's like finding the names. We are fortunate, I can find quite a few names because they broke our regiment up in 1945. Now, of course, when they were posted, there was a the posting list with name, rank, number and trade, see? Mm. So I can pick up quite a few of them now. Yeah. That's where I got the name, age of the officers, because, you know, we all got demobbed under what's called agent service group, didn't they, you know, and it's got all the officers there, you know, and so I got all those somewhere, but because I sound such a untidy matter like that, so, you know, everything gets mixed up. Alright, anything else? All I know is there was Alec Thompson, Dutch Island and myself. We were the spare three spare crews. George Phillipson was the fitter. Sid Lowers was one of the lorry drivers, you know, and one was called Hedges. I can't remember the rest of them, like, you know. Because, you know, once we were over there, you know, and when the rest of the tanks came over there, we think, because there was only two troops took part in the actual invasion, see. And the rest of the squadron didn't come over until about June the 16th to the 23rd, I think they were, like, you know. Because you've got to watch it, what the people say, like, because I have to hold my tongue, because one fella told his wife that, you know, his boat got sunk on the way over and the reason he was late and that, but, well, I know somebody else in the same crew and he said, well, our boat got over the wall. But, yeah, he was just I think possibly making excuses for these, didn't land on D-Day, like, you know. But, so, you know, I always say information is what is available at the time, like. I told you about the instance where, you know, Jack Washington was missing, like, and he was sitting in England, like, you know. And there were things, but, yeah, I've gotten the flamethrower, I've gotten the officer's summary of the flamethrower there, you know, action, like, and all they were asked for was more range. And they asked, you know, turret, but they say they wouldn't dispense with the turret in the guns, because the Americans had some of the flamethrowers in the turret, didn't they? But you see, you didn't have that when you were out in Germans. How do you fight the tanks, like, you know? So if you look at our records, we spent more time as tanks than what we did as crocodiles, you know. But, I mean, but that's the nature of the game, like, use what you've got. But I didn't say about Sopran Horrocks, did I?
No, you didn't put down, I think at lunch you did, but you didn't
Well, can I then
Yes.
Yeah, well, yeah. I met Sopran Horrocks, General Sopran Horrocks, I suppose you remember from it. He'd become a director of Bovis. And they were sent down to my job, and I was told to take him out and look after him. And he said to me, we're not going to one of these big posh lunches. And I always said, no. He said, well, as you know, I'm just down here sniffing the battlefield. I've just joined the Bowers. So I said, yes. So anyway, he said, you've got a little pub round the corner? I said, yeah, the Bricklayer's Arms. I said, that'll do. So the area agent and I, and the area manager, and some brown hearts, the four of us went to this pub and we had a big plate of sandwiches and a few pints of beer and we got talking about the war. Well, the brown hearts said to the area agent, what are you in? He said, I was in the Royal Engineers out in Italy. And he said to me, what are you in? I said, I was in the 141 RSC, the buffs with the flamethrowers. He said, I don't know how you can fire those things. But I said, you're the bugger who told me to. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I didn't decide I was going to flame over there or flame over there. I said, somebody up there must have issued the orders. He said, do you know what? He said, I've never looked at anything like that before. And he said to me, what was your feelings about? I said, I didn't have any feelings. I said, if they saved one of their men's lives, they'd done a good job. I said, and that to me was the criterion. I said, in fact, if you look through the records, you'll find when we got the infantry into a forest, I said, we carried a dismal. I said, and it can't have happened many times. I said, and the records show that on an average, if you had the flamethrowers there, there were 25% less casualties to the infantry. And I said, and therefore, as far as I'm concerned, we were doing a good job, a grand job, I said. But as far as the thing, I said, I know some of the blokes were very, you know, not happy. I mean, one or two of them went flame happy. That's when they just fired a flame at anything, like, you know, but they just took them off and that was the end of it, like. But, you know, I don't think the army are happy with the flame fires. As far as the army are concerned, it's a dirty weapon, like, it's done its job, we don't want to know any more about it, because they broke their regiment up in November 45. Okay, they did keep a few to hand them over to the Greys, but then they broke them up and gave them comments. And my feeling is that the army's opinion of the flamethrower was it was a dirty weapon and shouldn't be allowed to use. In fact, there was one instance, apparently the Germans used the flamethrower on some infantry near Tilly, and one of the commander, company commander, was so upset he wouldn't even accept to operate with the flamethrowers. He was so upset. But, to me, I mean, if they did a good job, our job was there to win a war and with the least number of casualties, and if we could save an infantryman's life, then it's up to us to do it, right? Mm. I mean, I suppose this was bred into us by Colonel Waddell, you know, I mean, the finest colonel in the British Army, as far as I'm concerned. He bred loyalty, discipline, and realism. And say this about Waddell: if your tank was on the road, you were finished. There were no petty jobs or duties. Your tank's on the road. But if your tank wasn't on the road, you worked 24 hours a day until it was on the road. That was your job. Your job is to be ready to go into action, and you work until it is. And he used to instill this in everybody, you know, that you've got to be ready for action. And that it was so much that he issued an edict, I suppose you call it, that everybody had to be able to drive a tank. The ability, whether it was good or bad, didn't matter, but finally they could move the thing. Because he said, I'm not going to lose a tank because some silly little clerk can't drive it. And that was his attitude. I'm a marvellous man. Although he got dismissed, you know, or sent back to England as a major, he still always attended all our reunions, and he was welcomed like a hero. As far as we were concerned, he was still our colonel, because there was a great loyalty to Waddell. Now, when Dougie Holmes started his this thing about he went, I think it was after a whitewash, I don't know, but what's the name, Cleves, Andre Cleves, Andrew Cleves, anyway, Linda Cleves, she was the documentary editor of the BBC, and they were going to make a film about Lee Harb, where Dougie Holmes refused to go out to action because he said there was swingers in the town thing. Well, I put him in touch with my mate who actually stayed in the town and met a naval architect who designed the Paris, the Normandy, and some other boat, and he gave my mate Titch the cap bands of the boat, still in the cellophane wrappers. Well, when she went off to see him, she had a 4-hour session with Alec, right? And then I thought, I don't know, I think he's after a whitewash, see, because he didn't do anything while Colonel Waddell was alive. This was after Colonel Waddell was dead, see? And so I phoned her up and I said, is he after a whitewash? She said, why? I said, well, that's what it looks like to me, see? So she said, do you know Corporal go to bed? I said, yeah, I know how he go to bed. She said, he asked exactly the same question. Well, I said, I don't mind him having a whitewash, provided every other soldier, I said, he was quite happy to go dancing around in England with 3 pips on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. I said, then when you come out there and ask to do a job, I did talk to Colonel Waddell about it, you know, I think he'd had a few whiskies like one of the reunions, and he said, I know I should have court-martialed him on the spot, he said. I didn't, but he said, and I paid the price for it, he said. Mm-hmm. But he said, how could I go home and tell my neighbour that I court-martialed his son? And apparently, Colonel Waddell and Dougie Holmes' estates were next together. Now, Colonel Waddell was a great friend of Harry Oppenheimer. In fact, his son married Miss Oppenheimer. Mm. Yeah, and Harry Oppenheimer used to come over to Colonel Waddell, and Colonel Waddell used to go to South Africa to him, you know. But there's no doubt he was the making of the regiment and that. Because you see one report where within 4 months he'd written a complete report of the regiment and everything they could do and everything they ought to do, you know. Oh, yeah, he seemed to have his finger on the pulse. Well, I told you about the gateways, didn't I? You know, mm-hmm. You're the gateway mad, don't ever go through a gateway or you're court-martialed. Right? That was it. It's really easy. It said, I mean, when you look at it, logical, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Do you want to field an anti-tank gun? Well, line up the gateway. know the silly idiots come for the gateway? You. And that's what he was drilled into us, and this is what it was like all the time. Everything had to be perfect. If he was about, he'd jump on a tank and say, what's that for? What's that for? What's that for? How many miles are you going to do? Did I learn about the flamethrower? I never described the flamethrower, did I? Now, the flamethrower is a 400 gallon tank. A trailer that is, say, weighs 6 tonnes. We've got 200 gallon tanks, 5 nitrogen bottles. Now, those nitrogen bottles are pressurised to 3,000 pounds per square inch. In fact, when we were in England, the railway refused to carry them because they were over the specified certified limit of 2,900 pounds per square inch, and they were 3,000. And they exerted the pressure on top of the flamethrower fuel, and that went through the Clayton valve and out and reduced to 350 pounds per square inch. Now, the flamethrower tanks went out to Korea, but they were never used. And Georgie Clare, one of our things, went out there because he stayed on in the army. He went out there with them. He said, no, we never used them. Well, when I was at the public records office doing some research, and there was a fellow there from, I think it was British Aerospace, I mean, he was doing research into friendly fire, the biggest, most known where there is. And I was talking to him when we were queuing up to get our documents. He said, what were you in? I said, 141. I said, I don't think much of the record is, there's some of the good ones, I think. And I said about the flamethrower, I said they had a amount of queer, they didn't use it. He said, no, he said, they didn't have any fuel. He said, that's why they didn't. I said, there's only napalm on it. He said, no. It was some secret fuel, he said, and they've never produced it since. And this is one of the reasons that we weren't allowed to leave a tank in no man's land unless it was destroyed. Then, if the tank got knocked out and you could manhandle the trailer back, in fact, Colvin, who was out in Canada, phoned me up about his father was second IC at Kirwanheim. I did an article, one of our crocs is missing, see, because what actually happened, we went into Trackless Woods, it was getting dark, right, and one of the tanks went down a bomb crater. Gun wrapped around a tree and it was sort of abandoned. So then we had to manhandle this trailer back over a railway back. Mm. But when we went back in the morning, all that was left was the wireless aerial sticking up out of the bomb crater. And he wanted to know, he sent me a map and asked me to put a cross where it was. Well, I haven't got a clue. We never knew where we were when the war was on in any case. So, all you knew was a field over there or a house, and that was it, In fact, you didn't know what day of the week it was or anything. All these things were peripheral, immaterial. You weren't going to do a day off because it was Sunday, so it didn't matter what day it was. Yep, okay, well, anything else? Okay, and then you had to put the cows out there.
Oh.
And then, September, the season was September till April in those days, wasn't it, for the football?
Yeah.
I remember that. Every Empire Day, they used to tile a bit of road. When we were going to school, our mothers used to hate Empire Day. Because they used to know we were going to come home covered in tile. They used to, when you went to school, there was heaps of shingle, right?
Yeah.
Well, they had an old horse cart with a furnace on it with the old tile, and two men on the side and a hand pump. Mm. And they used to spray it on and then just throw the shingle over.
Yeah.
And of course, we'd get hold of it and chew it and play. Because there was no squeegee on it in those days. The only way you could get it off was margarine. You'd put margarine or a bit of dripping on it, and melt it like. And there's always ructions at Christmas. At Empire Day. Oh no, not again. No. But Empire Day.